Welcome to the Fearless Future Podcast. I'm your host, Catherine McCourt, transformational life and business coach. On today's episode, I'm speaking to Alistair McBride, who is a coach, facilitator, and trainer, and has started numerous small businesses. He's a regular guest lecturer and facilitator at multiple universities in Ireland on topics such as cognitive behavioral coaching, entrepreneurship, and innovation. He coaches executives and business owners across an array of industries, including software, law, aviation, telecoms, and corporate finance, to name just a few. Over the past few years, he's been giving his clients the psychological edge in negotiation and is currently completing a book of the same name. Al has a new program out called Goliath Negotiation Method. Welcome to the show, Alistair. A real pleasure to have you on today. As you know, my podcast is all about transformation, business, and wellness. So I think you certainly will have a lot to contribute to that.
Thank you so much for having me, Catherine.
I first want to start with the fact that you have started many entrepreneurial ventures. Tell us about the most challenging entrepreneurship journey out of the ones that you have started, or what has been the biggest lesson that you learned along the way?
It's hard to pick one, but when I sat and thought about that one, there was one that really did come to mind. And I think it's because it was the significant change. So what I mean by that is I was an art dealer. I did art history and psychology and initially went the art history route. It was an art in a gallery for a number of years. And then I went out on my own. And what the insight that was probably greatest was that I used to be very competent seller, negotiator, you name it, when I was in the gallery. And I was very much what I now call a natural. You know, I enjoyed the game. I mean, it was all ethical. It was all in good fun, but it was just that. It was good fun. It was, you know, if I sold loads of artwork one week and the next week, it didn't really matter that much. Yeah, I got a bit of a cut, but it wasn't really me profiting or losing either way. And when I went out on my own, suddenly, after the brief honeymoon period, you know, you make that deal and you're doing well. You can go on vacation or whatever next month, you know, and if you don't, suddenly you're really having to tighten belts. And so
yes,
with those extra stakes, extra skin in the game, I became what I call a nice but nervous, where you don't want to ruin the deal. You don't want to push too hard. You don't want to push back too hard. You don't want to be doing anything too hard. And so you often leave a lot of value on the table. And that was probably the biggest lesson. And it was having to then be conscious of, like, what the hell is wrong with me? What changed? I'm not used to this. That's not me. All of this sort of stuff. And then having to actually go, right, okay, I need to mold these two together where there are higher stakes. How do I actually roll with that? How do I actually grow into that and deal with that? But also get elements of that old confidence back where you do see it in this more game-like fashion. And again, not to belittle the process by any stretch or the relationship in business, but the opposite, to actually bring back some of that joy, some of that playfulness, and some of that, just let's be honest, human-to-human interaction. Because I think the fear a lot of people have is that, oh, I don't want to come across too strong or aggressive. And they're absolutely right. But the other side is you don't want to leave that opportunity on the table, and that you can still be human. You can still be engaging. It's actually by being more engaged, you get a better response out of your prospects or your current clients.
Yes, I can totally relate to that. Just my background, of course, in sales and business development throughout my career. And you know, there is a very big difference to the conversations that you have when you feel this insane pressure. So let's say you're at the end of the quarter, or, you know, you're working for a business that is expecting a certain outcome by a certain time, and there's that certain pressure that's on you. Your conversations might be a little different, and certainly you can often miss some of the plot of opening up potential conversation to new opportunities. So totally get
big
that.
Big time. I mean, I think that just to say, the follow on from that is the insight that, you know, people love to buy it, but they hate being sold, as the old saying goes, you know. And it's an instructive saying. You know, I've been on a number of masterminds where I was asked about this. So, what do I say when I hear this objection, that objection? It's like, you're missing the point. Like, I get it, because that's the stressful thing that you feel stressed about or tripped up by. or the fear of being tripped up by that question. But it's the opposite. You need to align yourself with the value that you know your product or your service, the huge benefits that it brings, that you authentically, genuinely believe it will help this person with whatever difficulty or problem that they have. And be in that state. Be from that identity when talking about the process. And that way they're feeling that. They're bringing up a lot of these objections, partly, yes, because they're actual objections, but also partly because they aren't feeling sold. you know, desperation in any format is never attractive. So it's exactly that. But when you're bringing that sense of speaking to them from that place of serving, that this genuine benefit, those doubts, those fears and certainty starts got lower for a starter. But the second is they're also getting that underlining thing that I can ask this question, and if this is right, you know, you can have that confidence that you will roll with that objection. Like, yes, there are clever things that you can say, but Catherine, if you say something that tends to work for you, me just repeating the line doesn't necessarily work for me, and vice versa, because it has to be authentically in your voice, from you, from your best self. That's what builds the trust. So.
Yes. And often, like, I work with sales leaders who I try and work with them in a way to have even better conversations with their salespeople, to not just always focus on the number that they're trying to deliver, although that's truly what, as we know, sales is all about, bringing in the number for the business. But it is about what is the bigger picture and the bigger opportunity that we're trying to create with our clients, because that will build the longevity and success or sustainability in your relationships versus just going in there just to hit that number. So,
absolutely. I think you really hit on a key factor for me as well when you said the longevity, that it's not this short-termism that, again, when we have nearly too much skin in the game, too much running on, too much stress, we go in that fight or flight where it's survival mode, get it over the line no matter what. And you know, your client can usually feel that pressure. And these days, people have so many options that it's easier to say no, get out there, whatever level of politeness that they use, that they're effectively, the safer thing is just to say no, I'll go with another option where there's less pressure. So it's counterproductive, it's counterintuitive, as you said, that actually playing a little bit more of the longer game and just going back to caring about what their needs are and facilitating those needs, you know, reducing those objections and having what they need will be far more helpful in the long run.
Definitely. So I want to talk more about the negotiation side, but we will circle back to that. But first, just the fact that we were talking about your entrepreneurial ventures, and that, would you say that when you were starting these, and maybe you can describe a little bit about, you know, some of the businesses that you did start, such as the art selling and that, but would you say that when you were starting these ventures, did it really come from a place of passion, or were you looking for some more purpose?
It's an interesting question. I think they all had elements of purpose, most definitely. Some more directly over a sense of mission. Okay. But as you said, they all had elements of passion and purpose, because I think, as one of the reasons I responded to your podcast, was because of these elements of passion and purpose. I mean, purpose, it's the Nietzschean quote, you know, the one with the greater why can endure any how. And not that we want to be enduring, but, you know, if you're running your own business or going through a sales process, there's a lot of stuff you have to endure, for want of a better word. It's not all, you know, puppy dogs and rainbows and ice cream. You know, there's a lot of challenging situations. And when you have that purpose, that is your energy, that is your clarifying wake up in the morning, and you're just going to be better. And when you're on that mission, again, just like priming yourself, as I mentioned, for those interactions, that you are automatically in a better place. You're automatically going to go that bit further. You're going to have that bit of a better interaction with those prospects, with those clients. So purpose is absolutely key. And that's often, you know, when people get burnout, they've often lost that clarity of purpose or the clarity of mission. So, you know, don't get me wrong, plenty of people get burnout when they still have that mission. But it's also then that those are slightly other issues. But you have the purpose that is your energy, that is your motivating factor. Mm-hmm. You know, motives are the whole thing, the reasons, that's why you're doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. So what would you say is your purpose?
Yeah, there's a few elements to that. The key underlying factor, I think, keeps cropping up. And I might sound a little bit light or a little trite, is helping people reach more and more of their potential. Hmm. You know, I get a certain kick out of that when people are stuck or they find themselves plateauing or they find themselves not kind of being able to move to whatever level they want to move to, and being able to help facilitate that, guide them, or as you say, accelerate that. Catalyst to that is hugely fulfilling. In a more specific sense, and as part of that, then, is very much, as I said, in the negotiation element, is, you know, my own podcast is called Dealing with Goliath, and that is the point. It's helping the people often in the perceived weaker position to realize their strength and to actually be able to maneuver, not manipulate, but maneuver more powerful parties to a better outcome. And that's really key. So it's again about helping others fulfill that potential. It gives me a sense of purpose because they're doing better and better in their own estimations as to what is possible. Mm-hmm. And that's hugely appealing to me.
Okay, awesome. So share with us, you have an approach called strategic intervention coaching. Explain to us what that is.
Well, that was for one of the master coach there is Chloe Madonis, who's one of the great therapists and coaches of coaches in the United States, who's Argentinian originally. Remarkable woman. And strategic intervention is based on a few different principles, one of which is that it's sort of very much values or needs based, shall we say, building on Abraham Maslow's work, which is often, again, dealt with in a very thin way. It's a lot deeper than just the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, but it is based on this idea of that our actions, it's not so much important exactly what our values are or what our needs are, but it's more so how we meet them that's key, and seeing an awful lot of our behavior as vehicles that serve us trying to meet those needs. So it allows us an awful lot more compassion towards others and also allows us to swap those vehicles, but still meeting the needs in hopefully a healthier and healthier way. So that's a big part of it. But the other is different methods in creating change for people. And one of that is working through what they call the 7 steps for change, which is really all about, the first few are absolutely crucial in everything I do, which the first one is understand their world, understand the pictures in their heads, which is one of the most foundational principles by negotiation, where you're leaning, and maybe more, and it's partly in traditional negotiation, but more in what you might call negotiation mixed with where psychologists bring it. So negotiation started with economists, and then lawyers got involved, and then that was a certain perspective. And then, as I said, in more recent years, psychologists/economists got involved, where they're trying to base it in, you know, first of all, actual research, but more sort of emotional intelligence, more sort of how humans actually interact, what they actually care for, and what they actually motivates them. So the first step in that change, as I said, is understanding the world. It is the most crucial. Because if you don't understand the meaning that your clients make by certain, as I said, why they need certain things, why they're asking for certain things, then it's very difficult for you to facilitate that because you're looking at it from your own meaning, which may or may not overlap.
Yes.
And a big part of that then is that they feel that you get them. They feel understood, which means, like, oh, yeah, we're really on the same page. Oh, you really kind of get me. You really get my needs. You know, that is rapport. That is the basis of trust building. You mightn't be able to establish trust quickly, but you can establish rapport almost in an instant. And it's those little stepping stones of rapport that build up the trust, that build up that relationship, which buys you the benefit of the doubt. So if there are little misunderstandings, there are even slip-ups, or even if they feel slighted or irritated, that you have goodwill credit in the bank to draw on in those situations, rather than being very close to where anything you can create an overdraw, you know, that you're in debit. which you're in the red, which is not where you want to be. Because that's why when a lot of interactions are purely transactional, they can burn out very quickly.
Yeah.
Because you don't have that goodwill credit built up as a buffer for the natural human misunderstandings that we all have occasionally.
Mm-hmm. And it reminds me a bit of the different levels of sales individuals, but also depending on who your audience is. So, you know, a lot of what you do, I suspect, is a B2B scenario.
Very much.
But, yeah.
Very much.
And also, you know, when I say different levels of sales individuals, there is that transactional. When you first get into sales, you might be in a world that's very transactional. You know, you need that immediate close versus like some of the work that I imagine you do, or a lot of the work that you do. And of course, the work that I've done with B2B, which is a definite longer cycle. And some people don't realize like how much sales teams have to spend actually in those conversations to uncover a lot of what you're describing, to get to know what the vision is of your client and understand it from their perspective, not what you assume is their drive or their
precisely.
What it is that their outcome is. So great point.
Precisely, right.
So you've created a program called Goliath Negotiation Method. So it sounds like you've kind of described this, but what can you tell us more about what Goliath Negotiation Method is?
Well, there's a few different parts to it. So it's kind of a unique parts of my own experience learning and whatnot coming together. So guest lectured in cognitive behavioral coaching, the coaching offshoot of CBT, which is very popular. And so I bring in elements of that, both in order to be able to control your own emotional states, because a lot of these really high stakes and long sales cycle have these, you know, pinnacle climactic, hyper stressful meetings, where again, if you're in the weaker position, it can be extremely stressful. So being able to manage that emotional state and make your biology work for you rather than against you is hugely beneficial in that, because you can then start to employ all those other elements of your better self rather than, again, getting out of that fight or flight state into more of a challenge state. So you're able to adapt, you're able to strategize on the fly, you're able to improvise, but still growing and creating that sense of rapport and trust. And be able to listen and spot nuance. You know, when that is in more emotional states, it's very difficult to spot that nuance, to spot the reading those changes in emotional signals that you might be getting from that prospect. So it's very important. But from there, then bringing in elements of innovation methodology, you know, from design thinking, from lean strategy, all that sort of stuff, and bring in those methods of how we can actually uncover and create that hidden value. And over time, that can very quickly insulate your deal. Just like you were saying earlier about creating those longer-term relationships, it's another aspect of that where you're moving it out and above the transactional to bring in elements that other parties, third parties trying to encroach on that deal, or when it comes to renewal time, again, if you have those long cycles, that you've insulated the deal, A, because of the relationship, but B, because that relationship has then grown a certain openness where the client can express some of those ideas or their needs to you, and you have more creative ways of actually meeting them and meeting each other's needs if it's not just purely sales. And from that, then, as you said, when you're in those states, then the next level up again is being able to, as I say, ethically influence your audience. Or I say audience as in it could be a panel, you know. But ethically influence your counterpart or the people on the other side of the table. And in that way that you're able to gauge those needs because you've been listening, you've been, you know, taking out, you built this rapport, and then you can gently direct them. But it's also for very hard negotiators when they're dealing with very aggressive or highly experienced, even professional negotiators, that they're able to basically roll with the best of them, shall we say. Almost like sort of a jiu-jitsu thing. You have all of these methods to protect yourself, but without, you know, striking too hard back at them, but that they know that you're competent so that simple, silly tricks won't work on you. So all of that to both protect yourself, stand your ground, but also keep elements of that rapport. So it's a few principles I call. The first one would be, you know, think like a shrink so that you're able to stay, or think like a coach, but it's the same. So I'm teaching a lot of coaching principles that you can then apply to these interactions. so that you're coaching yourself and the other side to a better agreement. As I say, the first really is think like a shrink, where it's that idea that you're fully present, but emotionally non-reactive. And that's key. It's not that you're not emotional. It's that you're not reacting to the strategies and techniques, both from highly aggressive negotiators or salespeople. But they're easy to spot. It's usually the more charming ones who are super, oh, yeah, we're all win-win and we're all friends here. And then the next thing you know, you've dropped a whole ton of concessions for very little in return.
Right.
Which is often the case of really skilled ones. They don't so much use the hyper-aggressive techniques. But you're able to roll with that, as I say, but not in a way that will irritate or offend them in return. One of the others, and it's something I think we talked about before, which was the idea that, well, firstly, that I call it not a photo, a sculpture. So if you think of the analogy of a photograph, whether on your phone or a physical photograph, you can't look around it and see more.
Right.
It's flat. It's a 2D thing. But an awful lot of people think of sales or the negotiation in that flat way. It's this A to B transactional thing. And yeah, we have some ups and downs, but we're basically getting there. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you think of it more like a sculpture invites you to move around it, to see it from all these different angles. So just taking that approach as a primer to what am I not seeing? What's an opportunity that I don't see, either to add value for them or to add value for me? Or my side, right. Either way. And so we have an awful lot of methods to help people do that, but it starts with the assumption that there's more to see here. And the last, I suppose, then builds on that with the idea of no is the beginning. So again, coming back to them from innovation methodology, from discovery conversation, always be discovering, you know, never think that you know everything about this. And right. So it's very much this idea that when you're proposing something or suggesting a certain way to go or an add-on or whatever it might be, that if they sort of say no, then we don't sort of go, oh, okay, or don't get mad or sad, get curious. And that beautiful attitude of curiosity, oh, that's really interesting. So number one, that they can say no to you, right? And then building into that, oh, that's really interesting. Can they tell me why that is? So you're not objecting to it. You're just getting curious. Right. Oh, well, I saw it. Because about 20% of the time, they've misunderstood something. And it can actually happen, but oh no, I didn't mean that at all. Sorry, I apologize. I must have misspoke and whatever. You can clear up that misunderstanding. But the rest of the time, even if it's still not a goer, that's okay. You've learned something. It's another more understanding and rapport is being built. So, you know, no very much is the beginning of, is the end of one conversation, but the beginning of a whole other one.
Yeah. Great, great points. So who would you say is your ideal client for a Goliath negotiation method?
Well, there are a few. Usually they're either the business owner themselves, where it's a high stakes negotiation, often, as you say, most likely business to business, but not exclusively. I've had a number of very successful clients that are B2C, but usually there's a fairly high ticket item that usually requires multiple interactions. Sometimes right. Multiple in a very short period of time, sometimes multiple spread over longer periods of time. Basically, where, as I said, they have skin in the game. That's the key thing. So some people are in a structure where equity or there's some sort of equity share of their success. So I regularly work with litigation lawyers and to a lesser extent, but increasing MMA lawyers, because again, they're usually at that partner, getting to partner level or smaller firms where they're very much, you know, they do a good job here. They're going to be rewarded equally. They make mess of it, and it's going to really sting for a long time. So that's kind of the key thing. Similar with corporate finance people, if they're in smaller organizations where, again, they may not be the top person, but they much have skin in the game due to the reward. That as well, it's important that they have levels of autonomy.
Yeah.
They have autonomy over how they decide to interact, autonomy over how they choose to deal and interact, and how they choose to be the version of themselves they bring forward in those interactions is very important. And as a great litigator said to me once, Suti, I'm always surprised at how good a lot of these litigators are. So is, you know, the first negotiation is which version of you is going to turn. And that's absolutely key, Catherine, is realizing that it all starts with the identity we choose. Because, you know, we all have different roles. We're all moving from role to role to role. Whether it's, you know, daughter or son, whether it's parent, his brother, sister, friend, a sports coach, right? Boss, whatever that might be. We adopt different roles. So it's also realizing, am I going to be an attack dog here? Am I going to be a hard ass? Or am I going to be super empathetic? How am I going to be? And realizing that when we label these different roles, we can then move between them as appropriate, which a lot of my clients find hugely freeing, because then they can bring their best and most appropriate self and be highly dynamic in that as that conversation develops.
And an important part about that too is recognizing that as salespeople, we often do walk in a room, and if we know the client to a certain extent, we show up, you know, based on what we know about that person. Like, some people want all the details. Use a simple example. Some people want all the details. So you come in and you are, you know, ready to go through a sleuth of things. Others, they just want you to sit down and they want just the real high level points to this conversation, and that's it. So we're always molding ourselves, I think, as salespeople, but we do have an innate way of showing up authentically in certain conversations.
Absolutely. And the dynamism of how you show up isn't so much that it is totally authentic, in the sense that when we're properly present and alert to the needs of our counterpart, you know, it is extremely common, as I'm sure you know, that one meeting the person turns up, and they don't want to hear about anything. It's like straight down to business, right? And then the next interaction, they're super friendly, and you're going, is this the same person? And that's because of other stuff outside of you. We often think it's all about us. It's like, no, they're rushing to lunch. They have a lunch with someone that's important, you know? And they're like, I need to get this done. I need to prepare these other things. And then the next time, they're all out deep, you know, details and all the details. And that's fine. They're the same person, but it's being able to, again, pick up on these. That's a very obvious cue, obviously, because they're telling you, but it's the same point with maybe more subtle cues of how they need you to turn to best serve them in that meeting.
Mm-hmm. So, Alistair, what is the ultimate outcome that you hope your clients get out of working with you in this method, or just in general in other areas of your coaching and facilitating?
Well, there's a few there, and they all kind of link together. I mean, the first was going to my own purpose, which is helping people just attain more of their potential, unlock more of that potential. But it's also for business owners in particular, who this has a compounding effect, like compound interest. So if you can do, you know, even 5% better, 1% better on a deal, then that extra resources can then, that doubles back in. So if every deal you do in here is 1% to 5% better, never mind 10 or 20%, you know, it's one of these things that I talk about, you know, low percentages, because that's normal. But I'm sure, like yourself, you know, we've helped people get 300, 500, 600% better, you know, results than expected. That might not be typical, but the point is the same, is that any of those small gains loops back in to maybe then that gives you the ability to hire more part-time staff, more full-time staff, more advertising, more whatever it is the need of your business is that makes you more robust the next time that meeting, you know, the next client that you see, you're able to have, you know, a resource that helps you in your business in some fashion. So it's about that it's a spiral of positivity, of growth, of improvement. And that's really what I'm aiming to do. But it's also, as I said, giving people the freedom to harness more of their genuine self, that it's not about, because one of the big great fears that when I was doing a lot of discovery, when I was starting this off, from a lot of business owners, were two ones that kept coming up, which was really interesting to me. One was that they feared having to lower themselves, their standards down to doing really mediocre work or work they weren't proud of, which I was really impressed by.
Okay.
And the other that kept coming was having to fire good people.
Wow.
So, you know, from their own inability to close bigger deals or whatever, or get the thing over the line, and that kept coming up as well. So those are two fears that I'm hoping to continually help good people, skilled people, not to have to go near. I want them to do their better work, run their better self, and you know, keep working with really good people, both their own staff and growing their staff, as well as I said, with great clients.
Yes. So is there a certain level of business that you work with? Like, do you work right from small business or first starting out entrepreneurs to Fortune 500?
I meant to niche down. Some people say, oh, this should really be niching down. And I know that makes sense, but I do love the variety. I'm a terrible man for the variety. I love the variety. But as I said, it's really when people have that values fit with what I'm talking about, that they have that need to express themselves authentically, to be that better version of themselves, that they know there's more value that they're leaving on the table, that they know that there was a better negotiator might have got a better deal. You know what I mean? You walk out of the room, we got it over the line, but, yeah. And I'm reducing those buts. It's more, as I said, the psychographic profile of which I keep describing, rather than necessarily a demographic profile. But yeah, they're usually small business owners or well, but the commonality there, whether they're a business owner or they're working in a large corporate structure, is that they are often the perceived weaker party. That's where the Goliath, the classic David, Goliath, working with all the Davids out there, you know.
Okay.
And that's even if they're working for huge multinationals, because often then they're set up as one of five in what they call a negotiation auction scenario, where it's not a one-to-one yet. They haven't got the deal. So they're already given concessions, even though they know they're still in this 5-7 and then 5 and then 3-way interaction, trying to get a deal over the line.
Okay.
You know, so it's still their team of 5 or 7 people versus, you know, another multinational's team of 5 or 7 people. So it's still a very lonely place, even though you have a big brand behind a big logo. Yeah. Well, there's 20,000 people and you're a $1 billion company. It's like, yeah, but it's still your 7 people sitting in that room. That's all you got, you know? So it's oddly similar. Yeah.
Okay. Great. And what about resources? Do you have resources that people can check out or? You know, help support them, you know, maybe on their journey to get to know you.
Absolutely. Well, the first one is that I have a email mini course all around some of the kind of an introduction to a lot of these principles. Some of the things I've mentioned and others, it's a nice gentle little intro into, and it's at almcbride.com/mini course. And with that, you get a little intro cheat sheet as well. Which one of the first things it does is makes you get clear on your purpose, which is so much overlooked. People go, of course I know my purpose. And okay, tell me. And they kind of go, what exactly is my purpose?
Yeah.
Whereas when you know that, it makes you so much more dexterous, much more flexibility in how to get to your destination. You know, one of those traits of the greatest negotiators on the planet is that they're extremely clear on where they want to get to and why. But they are extremely flexible on how to get there. They're also weirdly open about a lot of these things that good negotiators who get good deals are still playing a lot of cards super close to chest and using deceit and false timelines and all these sort of tricks, so to speak, which can work and they do work and there is a place for them at times, but are generally not what people need. They're not the best route to go. So anyway, one of the first things I'd suggest is that mini course, because there's some principles that I introduce people to, and it's very light and people find it kind of interesting. From that, I'm actually just completing a book called The Psychological Edge in Negotiation for Business Owners, and that'll be out in May. So I'm very excited about that. So check either on my website again, or as I said, reach out to me on LinkedIn. I'm regularly on LinkedIn. I actually find myself weirdly enjoying LinkedIn. That wasn't the case a few years ago, but I'm actually quite enjoying it at the moment. So feel free to reach out and have a conversation there. Yeah.
Yeah. So I imagine, obviously, you have a website. So what would your website be?
Yeah. As I say, almcbride.com, almcbride.com. And as I said, /mini course is where some of those free resources are, so you can get a little taster. And as I said, to a lesser extent, people can check my own podcast, Dealing with Goliath. And there's a good number of episodes there.
Okay, great. And so I always ask my guests, certainly I would say in negotiation, you want to make sure that you are in your best form. So that's the wellness piece that comes in for a lot of people. They forget kind of to take care of themselves, especially when it's high pressure time, you know, and things are happening and they need to deliver. They often forget about themselves. So what would you say are some of your top or default self-care Sure. or wellness routines that you do or that you sometimes maybe share with your clients as well?
Yeah. Well, the first one, I suppose, is reflection. Mm-hmm. So it's amazingly simple, but people don't really. And I see this time and again with certainly business owners, but also executives, partners in financial institutions and law firms. There's always more and more work. There's always, oh, I need to get more productive. And so there's very little time for reflection. And the time for reflection, it's such a basic thing that when people even just, the way I get them to start is just when you come back from lunch on a Friday, schedule even 15 minutes to start with, then build it into half an hour, but even 15 minutes. And literally write what went well this week, what didn't, and what can I do about it? What can I learn from either of those? As goes strategically being aware of what to do or what not to do next time. And even just that is like, it gets us out of the patterns where we make similar mistakes again and again. We are pattern repeating habitual machines. And it starts to the first episode, just a little awareness. And you go, oh, that worked really well. I'm going to try that. Then you go, oh, I could add this thing to that thing. I never thought of that before. Or equally, oh, yeah, that didn't go great. Oh, maybe it's because of this thing, right? And suddenly you're in that meta, you're taking an overview of a lot of stuff, which is actually really what, you know, CEOs are meant to do. They're meant to be looking at these things from a higher vantage point. Whereas when we're in the doing the whole time, that's appropriate, but it's very necessary to take that bird's eye approach or what we call, you know, just zoom in and zoom out. You need to be able to look at the micro and the macro, hugely important. So that's number one. And part of that reflection then, is also the rest and recuperation, or what you might call expansion and contraction. There's natural orders to things. If we're always trying to, you know, charging the whole time and hard charger and go, go, go. Not just the reflection piece, but also just people aren't able to integrate a lot of that stuff. They're not able to actually recuperate. So it's like, you know, with athletes, some people hate that term corporate athlete, but it's in some ways it's actually kind of accurate. But if you think of actual athletes, it's the thing that's come along in the last 10 years. Professional athletes, it's yes, fitness, yes, diet, but the one that people have forgotten forever is sleep. It is literally the core of recuperation.
I would say sleep is so underrated.
It's huge. You're absolutely right, Catherine.
You can tell when you've had a good night's rest. And so you should always remember that, like, oh yeah, when I had that good sleep, I was like on fire the next day.
Absolutely. And the other addition to that is from Women Labs in Stanford, fabulous podcast on all things health and neurology and all sorts of stuff. But he calls it non-sleep deep rest. So even just closing your eyes at your desk, better to lie down on a sofa or a couch or something. But even just 15 minutes, where you're not really getting into sleep and actually put your alarm for just 15 minutes. But just proper relaxation, reset, just closing your eyes, your brain activity is allowed to go down so that when you get back into this is used to be, for example, Carl Icahn, one of the big Wall Street, you know, mega dudes. This was one of his secrets was he would schedule meetings for 8 and 9 p.m. at night and have a power nap, knowing that his counterparts wouldn't. They might have been up at 6 a.m. So he used sleep as a weapon. I'm not necessarily saying that. But the point is this, is that it's that powerful and also that detrimental if you don't do it. But just for myself, the other thing I do is the Wim Hof method. I've been an avid Wim Hofer for many years. The breathing, again, you're going into yourself, you're spiking sort of a stress response, but then dropping it down into relaxation. And it makes you a lot more stress resilient. And then the real physical thing, well, that and holding, you know, your breath for 2 or 3 minutes or 4 minutes or whatever it is you're able to do,
yes.
Which again sort of drops that, oh, what else might be possible? It's kind of putting it in real fact, real physiological experience, not just theory, you know? And then, of course, the cold showers, which spikes your white blood cell count and spikes your immune system and makes you much more robust so that you get sick far less. And again, same thing. it's not easy to step into a cold shower on a cold morning. But when you do, you feel amazing instantly. And it's also overriding that sort of the comfort need, shall we say, so that the mind is controlling the body, not the body controlling the mind. Your body's saying, what the hell are you doing? Are you crazy? Just turn into hot. And you go, no, we're going to have a great time. It's going to be awesome. Just the second we step in there. So it's realizing that you can do difficult things can be hugely helpful.
Awesome. Well, Alistair, it's been a pleasure to talk to you today. Great insights. And for the audience, if you're interested and if you are someone who is in negotiation or up against negotiation, then check out the Goliath negotiation method with Alistair.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Fearless Future Podcast is made possible by platforms such as Buzzsprout and Riverside FM. If you're interested in starting your own podcast, Buzzsprout is a great place to start to host, promote, and begin tracking your podcast. They have a 360-degree service and a ton of videos to help you get set up, choose the right equipment, and how to monetize your podcast. Their customer service is the quickest and most reliable to keep you growing and never stall your creative output. It's a super easy platform to use and connect your podcast to all major platforms for listeners to find you. So ready to launch your podcast? Go ahead and use the Buzzsprout link that I put in the show notes and receive a $20 Amazon gift card after your second paid invoice. Riverside FM is my studio platform that allows me to schedule and invite guests into a professional and interactive studio. You can have one or multiple guests, and it records separate tracks for ease in editing and creating clips. It's an intuitive platform that makes your videos look great and improves any sound quality, including sound effects. Follow the links in the show notes to review if these platforms can work for you. Want a secret for editing? Check out the Descript link that I put in the show notes. This is the easiest platform I've ever used to edit podcasts or any type of audio or video. So yes, you can upload video. You can get the transcript, and all you have to do is edit the transcript, and you're done. Super easy. Check it out. All the best on your journey, and have a fantastic week.